Okay, so here we have Dave Hollister, and he's gotten on his pacing phone so he can pace while he talks. I, too, actually can relate to that. Dave and I have known each other for quite some time, but I'm going to reintroduce myself. He knows I'm Richard Wirth and currently involved in the Masters of Entrepreneurship program at Western Carolina University. And we're conducting a series of interviews with entrepreneurs, and clearly Dave Hollister represents a significant kind of entrepreneur, in my opinion, cause-driven entrepreneur, and so therefore he's in a class perhaps not of his own, but I mean in terms of environmentally cause-related entrepreneurship. And so in introducing Dave, the things that have come through that are interesting about Dave is that, you know, unlike the pathetic cylinder thing, Dave's Sundance Power, founding Sundance Power, what year was that, Dave?
1995.
The fact that Dave actually succeeds with solar power without any significant or any governmental assistance demonstrates the pathos of the recent events where, you know, it's, right now it's estimated that $1.5 billion have gone down the tubes, not to the benefit of people who know how to make solar work like Sundance Power and Dave Hollister, but to people who just, who don't get it or who don't know how to where choices are made for funding by the wrong methodologies. Dave, despite Dave's a pioneer in this field and is the especially as a business, Dave is probably in the top one or two or three, and he'll state exactly, solar companies in Western North Carolina, and is actually does actually make a living at it, you know, despite while reducing the amount of kilowatts that we use from coal. And so I'd like to, rather than me talking about Dave, perhaps you could tell us about yourself in your own words, both professionally and personally, and understand we're going to be going through your business question by question as well. So if you could give us a brief description of yourself professionally and personally, that would be great.
Well, professional may not be the word to describe me.
Well, professional relates to your business, Dave.
I definitely feel that I am mission-driven within what I do. I started my career in environmentalism working at Greenpeace, and really took direct action in many respects, and for about 10 years really became comfortable with the idea that in order for change to occur, you can't think your way through change, you can't study your way through change, you can't emotionally bring things to change, but in fact change comes through action. Cahill Gibran says you move in passion and rest in reason. So much of what we did here was through our passion and desire.
That's a great thing.
To make the world a better place. So, you know, the question is, you know, what makes the world a better place? And so, you know, as we started to move away from the front lines of the environmental movement, taking direct action and getting arrested for what we believed in, my wife and I really felt that creating an enterprise that could really support the shift away from an unsustainable future, and a shift that could support people in their personal evolutions to take more responsibility for themselves and to become more fulfilled within their lives, and to really look at a way to create financial security at the same time. So really, this is what comes down to what people call the triple bottom line. People look at the triple bottom line from a corporate standpoint as like, okay, it's the people, planet, and profit. You know, that's the triple bottom line. But that's just not where it has to end. I mean, we also have to look inside the business and really look at, well, what kind of culture are you creating for the people in the business? Are you supporting them as evolving, divine beings that really have a mission and a path and a soul's purpose on this planet? And is there a way to truly organize teams of people, organize groups of people that can share, their experience in at work that is deeper than just, okay, I check myself out at the door when I get to work and I do my job. I'm the tool of the corporation. And so, you know, when I get to work, I just leave all that other stuff out the door. We really felt that the way businesses are structured and created was flawed, and that the old militaristic model of organization, where people were organized through authority, just wasn't working, and it was creating very unfulfilling positions and lives for people. And it's like a cognitive dissonance that people have, because, you know, all of a sudden it just became about how much money you have, and then people figure out that, wow, the money's not making me happy. So, you know, this is, I think, part of the transition that we're all feeling, not only with regard to the environment and shifting into a more sustainable way of relating to our
earth. So you've based
also the shift of people in wanting to have a more fulfilling place to be when, you know, you spend most of your time at work.
So is it basically when people come to work at Sundance, this is a different paradigm? You've created a paradigm based on not just financial existence, but actually spiritual and intellectual satisfaction. That there's been a step forward moved, and I'm a part of it, and your employees, and we're going to get to that in further question. And so you've created a different kind of business. Why I'm actually interviewing you, and knew that this was going to be a different kind of interview, and actually I relate to it more than some of the other more traditional approaches to entrepreneurship myself. I find myself in your paradigm, okay? You know, making the reason behind, say, Soul Ridge Farm or growing organic wild blueberries was the same. And, of course, my political actions against Nixon and stuff like that certainly didn't parallel the dangers you faced at Greenpeace, but I was in my war against Georgia Pacific and J.D. Irving, threatened physically with assassination, basically. In the search for a better environmental way. I didn't understand it as sustainability in any other sense other than the sustainability of the forest and the sustainability of the small woodsman. But let's go here.
So can we talk about sustainability for a minute?
Well, we will at the end, because there's a question at the end that really does that. In my search, you know, as a psych major, of course, for causal or correlative commonality, and I'd like to look a little at your childhood experiences, and could you talk about the behavior with and define your childhood peer groups?
If you have a couch, a tight-knit group of friends.
Wait, if you have a couch in your office, lie down.
I've lit the incense and I have definitely put on the meditation music.
Let's go back to the peer groups.
Well, I think what really was interesting for me I definitely always struck out on a different path. I mean, I tried to, you know, roll with the pack, but that just never worked. there's just something in me.
How are you different? How are you different from the pack?
Heartbeat. Well, you know, there's, I'm sure, lots of ways, but, you know, while everybody else was playing football and I was playing rugby, or I was out rock climbing and hiking, where, you know, most of the peer group that was around me was playing video games and, you know.
Yeah, but
I definitely was drawn more into a path of highly intimate, close friends and not loose acquaintances, and lots of loose acquaintances.
Rugby is simply a more vicious form of football, though.
Oh, yeah, but but it's definitely more of a flow. So I definitely gravitated towards things that were, definitely more in the flow and not quite as controlled. I think I was really into, you know, the adrenaline too, the rock climbing and stuff like that made me really feel alive in that way. And the friends that I had were, like I said, we were very tight and, you know, there weren't a lot of them, but the other thing was, is I could navigate through all of the school. So, you know, I was actually able to relate to lots of different people. I just didn't choose to really become close to a lot of those people. So yeah. It's kind of an interesting balance between,
clearly competitive, but, sometimes against yourself and sometimes in a group. Just a different, didn't go for the pom-poms, cheering you on.
Yeah, definitely not the cheerleader type.
Right. How did your peers perceive you?
I think, a little bit of, you know, same. I think it was pretty clear, you know, it's kind of cut from a different cloth. I think I got, in some respects, I was pretty bored, especially in school, you know, grade school. I understood stuff pretty quickly and pretty easily, so it definitely was sort of boring. So
that's not about your peers. It's about,
I kind of drifted.
Yeah, I think you're one of these.
I'm kind of getting to that. I mean,
you're one of these interviews, and there's a few where you answer the questions before they're asked, and that's very interesting. I want you to know that. You've said some of your favorite activities were rock climbing, and you may have fell on your head once, and rugby. What other favorite activities? There are two areas, you know, five to 12.
I did a lot of running. I ran a lot. I was also a gymnast. I was really fairly proficient at gymnastics and running.
A gymnast is not competitive?
Huh?
A gymnast is not competitive?
Yeah, I did not do competitive gymnastics. I actually was part of a group that went out and did shows. So it was more like, you know, more on stage. So I'd say that if anything, you know, a lot of my childhood was about me kind of reflecting and being sort of, you know, being on stage.
Well, but clearly your performance as a gymnast, when it got better, you felt better about what you were doing.
Yeah, although I think there was a general sense of insecurity that, you know, really prevailed. Because I really had a recognition that I was coming from a different place. So, you know, when you're at the end of the bell curve, whichever bell curve you want to look at, I'm not saying that I have any... You know, I'm not judging it as good or bad, but whenever you're sort of on the fringes of, you know, especially at that age, you kind of question it. Sort of like, wow, well, I'm kind of different, aren't I?
Well, you certainly don't fit Leave It to Beaver. So that's what makes, you know, you grew up in an era. How old are you, Dave?
48.
48, yeah.
I guess I'm lying. I think I'm 49.
Yeah.
Yeah, 49.
It's not good to lie, Dave. Obviously you've already answered by implication some of this. What was your attitude towards authority figures in your life, and do you know why?
Yeah, I did not really have a lot of respect for authority.
Well, that's very surprising.
And mainly because I just saw the holes in the logic. You know, I mean, I saw not only the holes in the logic, but also the hypocrisy that was oozing out of all of the rhetoric. So, you know, it's sort of like, you know, authority tends to come from a place where it projects an ideal. You know, and that is kind of a problem. It's sort of a setup for people because you imprint people with ideals, and then, of course, you never are going to achieve an ideal. So how can you ever really have any kind of fulfillment or satisfaction? You know, rather than giving people the tools to understand how to navigate from a set of moral values and you know, an actual pragmatic approach to life, we tend to dumb it down into these, you know, dogmatic doctrines that just, at some point, they just no longer work. And, yeah. In fact, I think that's what we're seeing on the planet right now.
It's kind of like these things when they accuse candidates of flip-flopping, when actually flip-flopping is exactly what we need.
Evolving.
Yeah.
That's evolution.
You know, we're complaining about candidates who changed their minds, but have the courage to change their minds, but we'll get into that too. That was a wonderful, analysis of authority and attitudes, but that was a very important thing you just said. Did you find yourself, let's talk about your moral compass that you just referred to. Where did you find that? Nature or nurture? Or both?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's something I think you find in your DNA, quite frankly. I don't think that's something that anybody can teach you. I mean, people can talk about it, but if you're actually going to really own it, it's something you have to see and feel and understand deeply within the consciousness that has created us. And I've been very lucky to, you know, have parents that were very, you know, they were very religious. So I, you know, obviously had a lot of imprinting on that level, but I think more and more as I've expanded my understanding, I think in terms of, you know, moving away. religion and more into a spiritual...
What was their religion? I mean...
It was Christian, Episcopal. Mm-hmm.
Episcopalian. This is two questions down that you've started to answer, which is, you know, what a true entrepreneur does is answer questions before they're asked, because they're asking themselves in sequence before the questions are asked. What type of jobs did they have, your parents? Which war was that?
My mom, World War II.
Okay.
My mom was, mainly a housewife, but she had hobbies, and they had a very strong sense of service and volunteering, and that was really a value, a value system that I really admire them for, that they constantly were giving back to their community in very significant ways, sitting on boards, volunteering. My dad was recognized by many groups, the Salvation Army. He actually sat on the board of the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
And then, again, when he passed, my mom did for a while, too. So he was an admired person, and so he got a tremendous amount of admiration and respect from his peer group.
Yeah, so,
I definitely...
You've kind of contradicted yourself a little bit, which is okay, because what you do is you get so far into one idea. So it's really a combinatory event of DNA and environmental childhood modeling that has had effects on you, both in terms of moral compass and in actual achievement, etc. Did your parents encourage free thinking and creativity?
Absolutely not. That was kind of the break. You know, that was definitely the break. That was the evolution. You know, that's where the strand of DNA radical, and next thing you know, that was the 60s generation. That whole concept was such a threat to their ideology, you know, their doctrine. It was just so far from them being able to understand what was happening in a more holistic and healthy way, and it really was being understood from a very limited, actually a prescriptive way. So, you know, in their era, life was prescriptive. It was like, this is what you did. You did this, you did that, you did this, everything's hunky-dory, and all's going to be well as long as you follow, you know, A plus B plus C equals D.
And of course, that was reinforced by the economic environment that they got a house and a car and food to eat and good school.
I mean,
and so therefore,
that was the...
Leave it to Beaver work.
Revolution. You know, that was the economic heyday of the United States and of the world. So,
did you find in this thing, you find yourself distracted, found daydreaming? Did you have big ideas? If so, did you share them or keep them to yourself?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have always been an idea person. And I definitely had lots of ideas. But I I was the last of five, so I didn't really rock the boat
Well, no, these are about... These could be a private activity of being distracted and daydreaming.
Oh, yeah. I was diagnosed with, you know, hyperactivity, attention deficit. you know, I was a Ritalin kid, so they put me on Ritalin. You know, I mean, I was like the last thing they needed. So, you know, one of the things that really...
So they found these
in my childhood was that, you know, I just was not doing any of the things that they thought I should. So, you know, I mean, I was like, you know, that last kid, they were older, my dad was older, last of five, and I was just wild. So, you know, I was a problem. And so the fundamental relationship I got was I'm wrong, you know, like everything I do seems to be a problem with everybody around me.
You should have seen my daydreaming and ideas. I mean, really, what you were negatively reinforced for is actually one of the essential commonalities of successful entrepreneurs. And I too was negatively reinforced for this type of behavior. I'm now going to move.
Yeah, but in your case, they were probably right.
Yeah. There's no question that there's psychosis that's provable in my DNA and environmental behavior. And also, I'm litigious, so therefore, since this is going on the internet, I have the ability to sue you for slander, even if it's true. But let's talk about your business. Let's switch gears to your business now. You went and founded, I assume the Sundance Power was your first company. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, first company. But, you know, when I was a kid, I had at least three or four businesses when I was, you know, before I graduated high school.
Could you quickly go over those?
Well, I had a little bike repair business that I did for a little while.
Uh-huh.
I had a snow plowing business that and lawn cutting business that I did for a while.
All right.
And then when I got in the later parts of high school, I actually helped a friend. I was an employee, but I helped a friend and was very close to a guy who had his own business, and I helped him really take his business to the next level just by knowing what he needed and filling the hole of what he needed.
What kind of business was this?
It was a fence company.
Uh-huh. So here's our little entrepreneur from teenage creating three businesses, and then
I sold hot tubs when I was in college. I actually had a little business selling wood burning hot tubs there for a while. that was sort of, and then I actually went back to the fence company for one summer, and really, that was like the summer that really pushed his business over the top, you know, and I really took control of the field for him, and it gave him this ability to really get to the next level. So, and then, you know, at Greenpeace, I actually created my own business within that organization. I set up the first North American equipment center where we housed and maintained and took care of all of the equipment that we used in our direct actions, climbing equipment, boats, engines, put in the proposal to the executive director, which he accepted and hired me to do that. So I kind of created my own place there.
One thing I know, Greenpeace demonstrated clearly that you were willing to put your life on the line for your passion and beliefs.
That's right. I mean, that's essential.
You've ignored that statement.
The same thing with rock climbing, you know. I mean, you get exposure. I mean, you have to be comfortable with exposure.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the thing. I mean, at some point, you know, there's always risk out there.
Well, then there's not always do people want to take risk, and that's the essence that we've lost in this country, and it's the essence of the entrepreneur, which is why we're interviewing Dave Hollister. Let's go to Sundance Power. Can you give me some examples to illustrate the challenge you faced in starting Sundance Power?
Well, I mean, essentially, there was no market.
That would be a challenge.
There's essentially really no market, or very little market, at that time. And so, but the notion, you know, again, this was mission driven. So, you know, it was about, you know, knowing, you know, it came from a deeper place, you know, that this was not like, okay, let's sit down. Let's do the, let's do the study. Okay, let's do the, where you invite people in and interview them.
Focus group.
The market analysis and, mm-hmm. you know, let's look at, what our target market is. Okay, let's do this, let's do that. I mean, that was not what, got us into the business. I mean, what got us into the business was just a deep sense of knowing that, seeing into the
future,
obvious future that was being created, that there was a train wreck about to happen, you know, that was coming down the pike.
So you were clearly ahead of your time, of course.
And so, you know, and this desire to want to create right livelihood in the world, you know, that I could feel good about what I was doing, that I could feel that I was participating in the solution rather than just, you know, sitting back and giving up and...
But didn't you have a thought?
The problem.
The reason why I can do this, because, you know, I've created 10 businesses, and sometimes I'm ahead of the time, sometimes I'm just before the time, sometimes I'm right on the time. And of course, the most profitable thing is to be right on the tip of the bell curve before it explodes, as Sorrel Ridge was clearly 6 years ahead of its time as an organic jam maker. So it's kind of like Atlas Shrugged. Your challenge is to educate people as to a need that they don't consciously understand they need, but somewhere there's a light inside of them, a fire, a little bit of a burn inside of them, and it's your job to add kindling to it and to actually educate, to actually educate the market and encourage that little spark, and that's an expensive and difficult process, as opposed to saying, okay, people want to eat cookies and people want to eat better cookies, let's make a better cookie. So the challenge you're describing is first creating, identifying and then creating a demographic target.
Well, so this gets into sort of some of the philosophy that I use to guide the organization. So, you know, I really look at, I want to bring out one issue because I know I'm going to talk about this and I can't kind of continue without really laying this foundation that, in that regard, while we did educate and we put people out there, you know, one of the foundations of Sundance was about educating people in the value of sustainability. And that was something we put a lot of energy into, and it was also one of the foundations of currently, you know, we have an outreach coordinator that, you you know, we pay her salary to give back to the community, to, you know, connect the cycle of prosperity. You know, if we're not giving back, then, you know, and this comes to the notion of what sustainability really is. And what
I'm glad you're going there, because it's an abused word. It's a misused word, I think.
So I want to define it in the way
that's what I would like you to do.
I see in its essence, at its core essence, sustainability is the balance between service and profit. That if either one of those two equations, if either one of the sides of that equation are out of kilter, if you're serving too much and not receiving enough, then that's going to be unsustainable. If you're, you know, if you're hoarding too much and not providing enough service for what you're getting out of it, that's going to be unsustainable too. In its core, you know, that the balance between profit and service is ultimately what sustainability is all about.
Well,
you know, much of our economic system is not resting on that ideal or on that notion. It's more of a philosophy. You know, we're about, okay, profit, bottom line, this is it, it's good. You know, you've got to create all this profit. And what you're seeing right now in the world is a bunch of the world is standing up going, hold on, the equation's not right. I mean, this is where you get the Occupy Wall Street folks and all this.
Okay, the last question in this interview relates to our current situation and we're related.
I know, so I'll leave that alone.
Let's leave that because we've got to get through
one of the things that we really knew going into it was that, you know, we were going to get out what we put into it. We were going to get out of our company the things that we were giving to people, that it became more about the service we were providing in the beginning. That was the juice. That was the thing that said, okay, if we can really, you know, provide a valuable service for people. And back in that day, you would go out onto somebody. Somebody might have a little bell that went off and say, "Huh, maybe I should think about, you know, living off the grid." Or it's like, "Hey, I want to put this house up on the top of this mountain over here," and they want, you know, $80,000 to bring the grid up to our house. Well, now you have this opportunity to not only, you know, we were able to change consciousness by being able to be in relationship with these people.
And how did you find these people? Find these people?
What's that?
How did you find these people?
We were out in the community, so we provided community, you know, we were at home shows where we're educating people. We were, you know, talking with friends and neighbors, doing, you know, presentations. You know, in that day, you know, we opened up markets in the sense that in our community we negotiated the first net metering agreement with the local co-op, where it allowed us to really connect these systems to the grid, you know.
So is it your company started in what year again?
1995.
So the challenge you faced in starting was actually developing the market, assuming that you had already understood the technology, right?
Yeah, and then, you know, the first shot in the arm for us was really Y2K. So, you know, that's when everybody started out of fear going, oh my God, what are we going to do? Oh, okay, we can go solar. So, you know, 98, 99, you know, was the first big boom years for us, where all of a sudden, you know, we'd kind of laid this groundwork in the years leading up to that. The other thing that we did as a company was we diversified.
It's called
fear. So we actually recognized that we couldn't survive just doing solar or hydro or wind or solar hot water. And so we recognized fairly good market for radiant floor heating systems, which were also a great delivery system for solar. So what we were doing was saying, okay, so, you know, this kind of leads into two things. One is it diversified our market, and so now we were able to work with a high-end group of people, fairly educated, kind of the demographic of folks that were starting to become conscious about the need to, you know, shift into more efficiency and more renewables.
Well, the entire baby boomer group.
The housing boom was going gangbusters. So, you know, the radiant floor technology, while it was not a renewable technology, you know, really helped us set the stage for future solar installations because, you know, back then we were able to make these houses solar ready and just put in a traditional heating system. And our rationale there, again, this is about having a value and mission-oriented organization, you know, was, listen, everybody's at a little bit different stage in their path, you know, of evolution. And so if we can help people, you know, take at least a small step in the right direction, then that fits our business model at the time. You know, if we could just do solar, great. But we knew we couldn't, and so we got into radiant floor, and our rationale was, well, A, it's a great delivery system for solar thermal, and it enables people to become more efficient, so they're going to use the energy more wisely. And so we really, within that technology, we put very tight parameters around what components we would use, where we would use it. Like, we wouldn't go out and put in snow melt systems out in driveways. I mean, we weren't into, like, you know, even though we could have, you know, made hundreds of thousands of dollars putting snow melt systems in.
I need one, by the way, so don't
leave that. We wouldn't do it because it's like, you know, we're not about putting, you know, hundreds of millions of BTUs into a driveway. That's just...
Well, I'm sorry. This driveway in Kalawee has to have it happen. But at any rate, I have 11 questions. I have 15 questions to go here. So, what I need to do is
guide the company through a set of...
Wait a minute.
A set of values and a set of, you know, that it has to fit our mission. You know,
right.
Set the guardrails up and then let the thing go.
That's a great sentence. Let me stop the recording now so that, because the megabytes will not be transmittable because the interview will be longer than the professor's megabytes. So I'm going to stop it.